All right, if you're going to follow along in your own Bibles, turn to Numbers chapter 3. Normally, when we take an extended break from a book study, it takes a good bit of introduction work to remind us of where we are in our study. That is not the case for tonight, because the way it works is the deeper you are in the book study, the more work it takes to catch you up when you leave off. We're only two chapters into the book of Numbers. So let me show you how easy this is. Basically, you can get all the refresher you need to put you in this study and have you in the right context just by looking at the titles of our previous two messages and the title for tonight's message. Numbers chapter 1, our message title was God's Army. It's probably already starting to come back to you. Numbers chapter 2, message title, Camp Organization. And then, of course, our title for tonight, Numbers chapter 3, Ministry Organization. That should have you sitting quite nicely where you need to be for our pickup in verse 1. Numbers chapter 1 was God calling and organizing his military. I kind of wish I would have named that Military Organization because our titles would have flowed better. Military Organization, Camp Organization, Ministry Organization, chapter 3. But chapter 1 was all about that, God calling a draft and then God organizing his military. Numbers chapter 2 was God organizing the general encampment of the nation of Israel. And of course, tonight, Numbers chapter 3, God organizing the Levitical ministry. And if you don't have a calling into the ministry, please don't tune the study out. It's not for me. Has nothing to do with me. I'm not ministry. I don't want to be ministry. I'm smarter than that. No, that's a joke. But don't tune out, as you should very well know by now, that regardless of where we are studying in the Word of God, there's going to be very useful and applicational truth for you, no matter who you are and what your situation in life is, truth that you can put to use right now in life. Hebrews chapter 4 verse 12 tells us, for the word of God is living and active. God's word, all of it, even Numbers chapter 3, God's word is a living word for living people. So there's something in here for you tonight. Let's begin with verse 1, Numbers chapter 3 verse 1. These are the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai, verse 2. These are the names of the sons of Aaron: Nadab, the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, verse 3. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priest, whom he ordained to serve as priest. Verse 4, but Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of Aaron, their father. There's actually a great deal of information to consider here in just these first four verses alone. Most important is knowing that there were ministry dividing lines, and it was based on descendancy. Levi was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Therefore, we refer to those 12 sons and all of their descendancy as the 12 tribes of Israel. And what God did was he had picked this tribe, the tribe of Levi, from which to draw all of his tabernacle workers that he was going to use in the wilderness and then eventually in Canaan. Moses and Aaron were both descendants of Levi, but of that generation of Levi, from that specific tribe of Levi, God picked Aaron to be the ancestor of all the priests. So that's where that dividing line sits. Every person that is a descendant of Levi, that tribe that is way back in the history of the nation, they are capable of being ministry workers, Levitical workers around the tabernacle, but not all of them were eligible to become priests and actually work in the tabernacle. God chose only Aaron's line for that. So, as I've said before, to be a priest, well, let me back this up, because the terminology, we use the terminology a little bit interchangeably. I admit I'm guilty of this too, and I'm fine with the fact that I do that, just sort of lump it all together, Levites and priests. But there really was a dividing line there. You could be a ministry worker, as I've said many times before, if you had Levi genes, right? If your genetics came through Levi, you could be a worker. But in order to be an actual priest, you had to have Aaronic genes. Isn't that ironic? The genes of Aaron. And so here's the way that it works. All priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. So verses 1 through 4 begins by revealing to us the deficit that the Lord begins with. The deficit being that Aaron only had four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And as verse 4 has reminded us, two of those sons, Nadab and Abihu, have already died childless. That means there are no other generation of priests coming from either one of their lineages. That lineage, that progeny, has ceased to be with the deaths of Nadab and Abihu. You can study back through that in Leviticus chapter 10. You remember the story, I'm sure. They came that day to burn incense before the Lord as they were supposed to, but they didn't bring the right fire that they were supposed to use on that altar of incense. God had commanded them that the fire that was to be used on the altar of incense, that fire needed to come from the brazen altar, the altar of sacrifice, and that's not what they did. They flicked their bick. They used their own light. They used their own fire, and they were also guilty, we believe, based on a new law that the Lord made in that instant, in that moment. We believe that they were also guilty of coming at least somewhat inebriated in order to perform their duties as priests. Now, it is not just those two priests that remain from the sons of Aaron, Eleazar and Ithamar. Those are not the only two priests. And then, of course, Aaron being the high priest, you're not just moving forward with three priests. Eleazar and Ithamar did have children, and those children can be priests in the tabernacle. But you start with that deficit of all of the future, every bit of the progeny of the priesthood is going to come now through just two guys, Eleazar and Ithamar. But what I like about this is that though the Lord starts out with a deficit, he doesn't stretch the rules in order to accommodate being more fully staffed. I like that about the Lord. The Lord will never do that. Not even in the Old Testament, when you study qualifications for New Testament ministry workers, you're never going to read the clause from the Lord, unless you're short-handed, right? A pastor should be above reproach unless you're short-handed. An elder should be self-controlled unless you're short-handed. Ministry workers should not be drunkards. They should not be violent, and they should not be lovers of money unless you're short-handed. Then just, you know, do the best with what you got. The Lord never does that. He does not change his standard based on whether there's a shortage of workers or not. Now, and I realize I sound an awful lot like Coach Mike Tomlin of the Pittsburgh Steelers when I say this, but as far as God is concerned, when it comes to the work of the ministry, the standard is the standard. And if someone doesn't measure up to the standard, third string they go. No. If someone doesn't measure up to the standard, it is not the standard that goes, it's the candidate that goes. Now, in Old Testament times, if you did not meet the standards, there wasn't anything you could do because these were genetic standards. If you didn't have the right genes, you couldn't be a part of this, and there wasn't a thing that you could do about it. But this is all the more palatable for the New Testament Christian because as far as New Testament ministry goes, being qualified for ministry is always within our reach. If we don't meet the qualifications for ministry, all we have to do is study them, pray, seek the Lord, and then let the Lord change us and continually change us until we do rightfully meet the standards for ministry. We call that sanctification, right? Verse 5, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 6, bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest that they may minister to him. Verses 1 through 4, that is dealing with the tribes of Aaron that would constitute the actual priesthood. But now we're talking about Levites in general. So these are general ministry workers. What God is doing here in verses 5 and 6 is he is establishing a workforce to come alongside of Aaron and his sons and assist them and support them in the tabernacle ministry that they are doing. And maybe you're wondering, well, if this is all true, if there's a dividing line, and everyone born from the lineage of Aaron is eligible to be an actual bona fide priest, but these other Levites, anyone that comes from that tribe of Levi in general, they're able to be ministry workers of some sort, but what is it exactly that they are assigned and called and allowed to do? And the Lord is going to, in this chapter, answer those questions for them and for you if you have those questions as well. It begins at verse 7. Here's what these general ministry workers, these Levites that aren't from the Aaronic tribe, here's what they can do for the Lord and the work of the tabernacle. Verse 7, they shall keep guard over him, that's Aaron, and over the whole congregation before the tent of meeting as they minister at the tabernacle. Verse 8, they shall guard all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and keep guard over the people of Israel as they minister at the tabernacle. Verse 9, and you shall give the Levites to Aaron. Look at that wording very closely. You shall give the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are wholly given to him from among the people of Israel. Verse 10, and you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall guard their priesthood. But if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. So in other words, no enlisting anyone who was not biblically and genetically qualified to be a priest. It didn't matter if you were in a pinch or not. Didn't matter if you were short on workers or not. That was a no-no. Don't do it. Verses 7 through 10, that gives you a pretty good breakdown of all of this. Here's basically what this looks like in a nutshell. Anything spiritual would be in the wheelhouse of the priests. And anything physical, any of the work that was physical or material, that would be in the wheelhouse of the Levite ministry workers. Yes, that was just for Jason. I wanted to make sure he understood this. What I love about this is that it is broken down in the Old Testament in the same way as it is in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, you have these two categories. You just put it like this, priest and Levites. Now again, all priests were Levites and not all Levites were priests, but in general, you have those two categories, priests and Levites that were not from the tribe of Aaron and therefore were not priests. So you have priests, you have Levites, and the roles are spiritual and then physical. And in the New Testament, if you look at the New Testament, there is that same categorization, those two categories, those two divisions of the work of ministry, and they are summed up in the qualifications given to us in Paul's writing to Timothy about, number one, elders, and number two, deacons. It is that exact same division. The elders are to be responsible for the spiritual aspect of the work, the teaching, the preaching, the writing literature, whatever's happening in a church, the spiritual ministry, that's the elders, and then the physical material ministry work, that is organizing the potlucks and cleaning up the facility after service and being an usher and being a parking lot attendant and all those things, that falls under the category of deacon, which is the physical and material work of the ministry. Neither one of those is better above the other. They are both very much needed, as it was in the days of the Old Testament, so it is in the days of the New Testament. We need all of that working together in order to make all of this go. But I love that if you look at this without the different terminology, without the different titles, without the different work assignments and work duties, if you just look past that and look at the big picture, you see God never really does change the way that he organizes his program. He breaks that up right there at that dividing line, spiritual and physical. And the reason is obvious. You can't have the guys that are supposed to be focusing on the physical work. You can't drag them outside of that and detract from that by having them do the physical work of the ministry and vice versa. You can't have the guy that's supposed to be an usher, but last minute he got called on to give the teaching. So you divide those up, spiritual and physical. God always operates his program, Old Testament to New Testament, in very much the same way if you strip away all of the specific language and all of the specific duties. Verse 11, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 12, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the people of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the people of Israel. The Levites shall be mine. Verse 13, for all the firstborn are mine. That's already a given. The firstborn were already the Lord's, and now the Lord says, the Levites I am claiming for myself. Reading on in verse 13, on the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated for my own all the firstborn in Israel, both of man and of beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord. So hopefully you see what happened here. When God delivered Israel from Egypt with that 10th plague, which was the death of all of the firstborn, God made a sacrificial provision in order to provide a plan of redemption for Israel's firstborn. And you know the way that worked. It's that type of Christ that we have, the sacrifice of Christ, that if you would take a lamb and you would slaughter that lamb, and then apply the blood of that lamb on the doorpost of your home, any firstborn that belonged to that home, the Lord would pass over. That's the first Passover, right? The Lord would pass over them. The Lord would spare them. The Lord would redeem them. And we know immediately what happened after that is that the Lord said, okay, if I'm going to spare the firstborn of the nation of Israel, if I'm going to let them live and pass over them because of this sacrifice, here's what I want. I want them to belong to me. I want them to be mine. What he meant by that was going to be the pool of candidates that the Lord would use and draw from in order to fulfill the ministry positions that would be coming up through this tabernacle and all of its services and offerings. So that was the initial setup. I've spared the firstborn, so I claim the firstborn. They are going to be my workers. But then something major happened. Exodus 32. Before Moses could get down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, the people had already plunged into idolatry, and the Lord was angry about that. And only one tribe, that would be the tribe of Levi, was willing to stand up in that moment and do what needed to be done to rectify that situation, to take a very harsh stance against transgressions of God's laws. And you can read that on your own time later, Exodus chapter 32, verses 25 through 29. But for tonight, I just want to speak to you about verse 29. Because in verse 29, that verse tells us that when God saw the tribe of Levi do that, God instantly decided in that moment, I'm taking them instead of the firstborn. The firstborn are mine. The nation of Israel owes that to me. I spared them, so they are mine for the purpose of ministry. But something changed. Something happened. I now have decided to take the tribe of Levi instead of or in place of all of the firstborn within the nation of Israel, because it was that tribe of Levi that was willing to do what no other tribe would do. And in so doing, they showed their extreme devotion to God. What this effectively does is it takes God's choice from being random birth order. If you're the firstborn, whatever tribe you come from, whatever family, doesn't matter. If you're the firstborn, you're part of the ministry. That would be my brother and not me. He'd have to be up here doing this and not me if it still worked that way. Sometimes I think that'd be better for me. Less work. But instead of it being random, here's what the Lord decided. No, I don't want it to be random. I got something better than that. I am going to pick the most spiritual of the tribe. And that's the tribe that I'm going to use for ministry. I think it was a brilliant choice by the Lord. He picked those who showed that spiritual initiative and devotion to his laws. And God said, that's going to be my ministry group. Now, the Lord begins this exchange, this swap of the Levites, instead of the firstborn of Israel, as we read in the verse, by taking a census of all the Levites. And that begins in verse 14. Let's read. And the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, 15, list the sons of Levi by fathers' houses and by clans or tribes. Every male from a month old and upward you shall list. Now, why does the Lord start the census at 1 month old? Well, obviously, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly why, but I can almost guarantee you that the reason why the Lord began this census at 1 month and older is because the infant mortality rates back then were much worse than they are for us today. And a child was in a very shaky time period within its life within that first month. But in this culture and in this time period, if a child survived that first month of infancy, that child was far more likely to develop and survive and go on and live a good life. So I think what the Lord has done here is he has based this census on the most stable of the statistics that he could gather. If he was picking from birth, the reality of infant mortality rates would probably throw these numbers all out of whack. It would be a very shaky statistic to build this census off of, and I think the Lord picked the more stable of those statistics to build this census from. Verse 16. So Moses listed them according to the word of the Lord, as he was commanded. Verse 17. And these were the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon and Kohath, and Merari, verse 18. And these are the names of the sons of Gershon by their clans, Libni and Shimi, verse 19. And the sons of Kohath by their clans, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, verse 20. And the sons of Merari by their clans, Mahli and Mushi. I got to say something, right? I'll be kind. I'll just say this. I'm sure Merari had a lot of strengths in his life, but naming sons was not one of them. Two kids, two boys. What should we name them? How about Mahli and Mushi? Just want to take this opportunity of time to thank Barry and Megan for doing a wonderful job of naming their child. Within gender lines, too. That's important as well. So reading on verse 20, these are the clans of the Levites by their father's houses. So the Lord, what he's doing is breaking this census up into three different divisions, and he's going to let each one of these sons of Levi serve as that division break. Because ultimately what he's going to do is he is going to divide the physical work of the Levites up in this chapter. He's going to make assignments. He's going to give them their work duties. He's going to put this all as a part of this census so that by the time they go to each one of these sons and they take up the census for that son, then that son is also going to get, or, you know, that son and anyone through that lineage from that tribe is going to get an instant knowledge of what their duties and assignments are from the Lord. And just to point out that when the Lord does this, when he decides where to make this division, this three-part division, to divide up, to divide up the ministry work, he goes way back further than Moses and Aaron. This goes all the way back to the tribe of Levi, right? Levi, one of the sons of Jacob, that's the major tribe that all of these ministry workers come from. God goes all the way back to Levi, takes the three sons, which was Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, and he lets that divide up the labor. Now, quick question for you. Does anyone know the tribe that Moses and Aaron come from? Was it Gershon? Was it Kohath? Or was it Merari? It was Kohath, all right? It was Kohath. And if you look at verse 19, you should see a familiar name in there. You'll see the name Amram. Who is Amram? Amram, as we read there in verse 19, he was a son of Kohath. And Amram was the husband of Jochebed. And Amram and Jochebed were the parents of Moses and Aaron and Miriam. So, anytime you read in the Old Testament about the Kohathites, just as a little point of intrigue and interest, when you read about the Kohathites, that is the tribe that Moses, Aaron, and Miriam are linked to. So now you have that knowledge. The question is, will you remember that knowledge when we eventually get there and read about the Kohathites? Probably not. But good luck with it. All right, now here comes the first tribal division, verse 21. To Gershon, the first son of Levi, belonged the clan of the Libnites and the clan of the Shemites. These were the clans of the Gershonites, verse 22. Their listing according to the number of all the males from a month old and upward was 7,500. So you could underline Gershon and you could underline 7,500. Verse 23, the clans of the Gershonites were to camp behind the tabernacle on the west. So if we could pull up that graphic, we've already looked at this graphic, but just to pull this up and take another look at it so that we can see Gershon's placement within the encampment of the nation of Israel. We just read that this was to the west. This was behind the tabernacle. Here's the tiny little tabernacle here in this graphic. These are the front doors of the tabernacle. This is the backside. Here is the tribe of Gershon, the group that we're reading about now that was 7,500 people strong. That is where they are going to encamp. And now we're going to read on and take a look at the assignments and the duties that go along with being a Gershonite, a member of the tribe of Gershon. Verse 24, with Eliasaph, the son of Lael, as chief of the father's house of the Gershonites. So in other words, Eliasaph is going to serve as the tribal leader here. He's like the overseer. Verse 25. And the guard duty of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle. Tabernacle means tent, which this passage goes on to explain. The tabernacle, the tent with its covering, the screen or the curtain for the entrance of the tent of meeting. Verse 26. The hangings of the court, the screen for the door of the court that is around the tabernacle and the altar, and its cords, all the service connected with these. So in other words, God says, Gershon, it's curtains for you. Curtains, see? It's not as bad as it sounds. It's not a mafia hit. This just means that Gershon is going to be responsible for all things tapestry. If it's a tapestry of some sort, if it's a skin or a cloth, then the tribe of Gershon is responsible for it. Everything but, and I do want to make this this point, everything but the veil of the temple. It's sort of strange, but everything, skin or cloth or tapestry, that's all in Gershon's wheelhouse, Jason. So you have those huge, remember those huge multi-layered coverings that went over the entire inner tabernacle structure and covered the whole thing layer after layer? They were responsible for those. They were responsible for the screen or the curtain that would hang at the gate of the outer courtyard itself to get into the entire structure. That curtain, that screen was their responsibility. Then that screen or that curtain that went from the outer courtyard into the inner tabernacle structure, that screen was their responsibility too. The only one that wasn't was the veil of the temple, the veil of the tabernacle, which separated from the holy place and the Holy of Holies. That was not their responsibility. The only item of cloth or skin or tapestry that Gershon was not responsible for. So everything else, anything tapestry, when it was time for God to get the nation up and moving, tear down, transport, set up at the next location, they would be responsible for all of those things, cloth, skin, and tapestry of any sort. Here's the second tribal division, verse 27. To Kohath, the second son of Levi, belonged the clan of the Amramites, and the clan of the Izharites, and the clan of the Hebronites, and the clan of the Uzielites. Ooh, I got it. I didn't think I was going to be able to nail that one. These are the clans of the Kohathites, verse 28, according to the number of all the males from a month old and upward, there were 8,600 keeping guard over the sanctuary. So you could underline Kohath, and you could also underline 8,600. Verse 29, the clans of the sons of Kohath were to camp on the south side of the tabernacle. So again, let's pull up that graphic. We're going to be popping that up over and over again. So this is Kohath, and I know you can't see this, but if you look down here, there's a little number menu, and you got Kohath number 2. So they're on the south side of the tabernacle. That's their little area of encampment. And as we read on, we're going to see the ministry assignments and responsibilities of the Kohathites. Verse 30, with Elizaphan, the son of Uziel, as chief of the father's house of the clans of the Kohathites. So Elizaphan is going to serve as the leader of this second group, the Kohathites. Verse 31, and their guard duty involved the ark, that's the Ark of the Covenant, the table, that's the table of showbread, the lampstand, the altars, that would be the brazen altar and the incense altar, the vessels of the sanctuary with which the priests minister, and the screen, that's talking about the veil of the tabernacle between the holy place and the Holy of Holies. All the service connected with these, okay? This is the tribe from Levi from which the priesthood descends, the Kohathites. So they get the assignment and duties of moving the most spiritual furnishings of the tabernacle. This was any station that involved service or offerings to the Lord. All of those stations were managed by the Kohathites. They were responsible for it, along with, as we read, the veil of the tabernacle. Now, verse 32, two tribal divisions have been covered, but before the Lord covers this third tribal division, he's going to give us a one-verse insert to sort of shore up the organization of all of this. In verse 32, he tells us that Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, was to be chief over the chiefs of the Levites and to have oversight of those who kept guard over the sanctuary. So we read of two of those chiefs already, That was Eliasaph and Elizaphan. Those were chiefs over those first two tribes of Levi. The third one is going to be given to us in verse 35. It's going to be Zuriel. So you have these three guys sort of overseeing their whole tribe. But now you've got Eleazar, a priest, the guy doing the spiritual ministry, one of the sons of Aaron. You got him in charge of those three guys. So it's Eleazar that gives the commands to these three chiefs over their tribes, and then it's their responsibility, Eliasaph, Elizaphan, and Zuriel, to go to their individual respective tribes and be certain that the work that is carried out there meets the standard that is called for by Eleazar, the chief of the chiefs of those tribes. So Eleazar was the New Testament equivalent of the head deacon. Remember, this is all dividing up spiritual with the physical. And I know Eleazar is the priest. He's in charge of the spiritual stuff, but he's also in charge of the physical stuff as well, the physical ministry, the material ministry of the group. So he's like serving as the head deacon here. He's calling the shots for the physical labor of the Levites. And now we get to the third tribal division, verse 33. To Merari, the third son of Levi, belong the clan of the Mahlites and the clan of the Mushites. It doesn't sound any better when you put ites at the end of it, I don't think. The Mahlites and the Mushites, these are the clans of Merari, verse 34. Their listing, according to the number of all the males from a month old and upward, was 6,200. So you might want to underline Merari and the number 6,200. Verse 35, and the chief of the father's house of the clans of Merari was Zuriel, the son of Abihail. He's going to lead this third tribal division, as we've said. They were to camp on the north side of the tabernacle. Again, let's pull that graphic up so that you can see Merari's placement within the encampment of the nation. Merari number four. We got number four here. This is north of the tabernacle. That's where they are to be situated. And now we want to take a look at their duties, the duties of the tribe of Merari. Verse 36, and the appointed guard duty of the sons of Merari involved the frames of the tabernacle, the bars, the pillars, the blankets, just kidding, the pillars, the bases, and all their accessories, all the service connected with these. Verse 37, and the pillars around the court with their bases and pegs and cords. Now, as I sit and try to figure this out, it would seem to me that God picked the smallest tribe, only 6,200 people, and he assigned the smallest tribe to be responsible for the heaviest workload when it comes to setup, tear down, and transport of the tabernacle. I don't know if you remember all the way back when we studied through all of the components of the tabernacle, but the things we just read about, these were heavy items. And there was a lot of them. Most of this is some form of metal, and a good portion of it is these huge planks that were gold-plated, covered with gold. Now, to put this in perspective, imagine yourself going to Home Depot. I have to say Home Depot because two Sundays ago I said Lowe's and offended Charlie. Imagine yourself going to Home Depot, and you're going to buy all of the boards that you need to put up the framework of a nice big house. But now imagine every single one of those boards is gold-plated. And now imagine that you own a Chevy and your Chevy broke down, so you can't use your truck. You have to move it all by hand from Home Depot to your house, to your land. It's a good time to have a lot of friends. That kind of puts it into proper perspective. The workload that was on the smallest tribe of Levite workers, but all I can say to that is that if God thought that they were up to the challenge, then they were. If this is the way the Lord set it up, then I'm confident, I'm positive, I'm absolutely sure that though this workload was heavy, they were able to fulfill their obligation to the Lord without any problems. Verse 38, those who were to camp before the tabernacle on the east, before the tent of meeting toward the sunrise, were Moses and Aaron and his sons, guarding the sanctuary itself to protect the people of Israel, and any outsider who came near was to be put to death. All right, one last time, let's pull up that graphic so that everyone can see where Moses, Eleazar, and Ithamar's placement within the encampment was. You got number one, Moses, Aaron, and sons. Where are they? Boom, right there. Smallest little group on the east face, the east side of the tabernacle itself. That's the doors. They're right there at the doors. They have the primo spot. They're in that spiritually significant direction of east. That's the direction that the Lord is going to come back from. They are situated right there at the door of the tabernacle. And I got to tell you, it's got me rethinking my church parking spot. Why am I parking in the lower lot on Sunday mornings when I could be right at the door like Moses and Aaron and... No, not really. Actually, I was offered a parking spot pretty early on. Someone asked me, do you want me to see about getting you a pastor parking spot? I turned that down. I said, no, let's leave those close spots to the people that need a shorter walk from their vehicles to the sanctuary. But you know what? Give it about 10 years, I might be one of those people. We might have to rethink that. Pastor parking, first spot. I might need ushers to help me in too. Who knows? Lord willing, it won't be like that. But for now, I'm just fine with how things are. Okay, beginning at verse 39, God already knows whether this exchange of Levite for firstborn is going to be a fair exchange. He already knows that. But what he's going to do is he is going to detail this out for us so that the rest of the nation can see that this exchange is going to be fair and equal. He does a compare of the total number of Levites with the total number of the firstborn. So let's take a look, verse 39. And though all those listed among the Levites whom Moses and Aaron listed at the commandment of the Lord by clans, all the males from a month old and upward were 22,000. Does anyone have a problem with that number? Well, if you're doing the math, it doesn't total up to 22,000. You have Gershon, 7,500. You have Kohath, 8,600. You have Merari, 6,200. And when you add that up, you come up with 22,300, not 22,000 even. So what's happening here? Is the Lord just rounding off? Well, he's not going to do that with the other number. And he's going to make up the difference, so it can't be that. What's taking place here? Well, some would suggest that there is an error in the manuscript that this is translated from, and that earlier manuscripts would have had the accurate number, and we're not sure which is which. The New King James Version actually makes that change within the numbers, and therefore the numbers in the New King James Version totals correctly at 22,000. However, to say that there's an issue with the manuscript that we translate from, that doesn't take anything away from the veracity of God's word in the original manuscripts, but what it does do is it raises questions about the manuscripts that were used to translate this section. That would make me very uncomfortable. Like, do we not have a good manuscript to make this translation? So I don't think that's it. I don't think that's the issue whatsoever, and I don't think that is what produces the discrepancy. That's always going to be a last resort belief on my part. So some commentators say that what this is it's taking into account the firstborn within the Levitical tribes. And that's a good point. You know, there are firstborn within those Levitical tribes, and the Lord is trying to even out, how many firstborn in the nation overall do I have, and how many Levites do I have? Therefore, the Lord would have to zero out the firstborn of the Levites, because they have to be factored in on this other side. You see what I'm saying? Because the Lord's wanting to make this exchange fair. That could be, and I think very likely that is possible. By the way, that is the belief of the writers of the Talmud. If you don't know what the Talmud is, those are early rabbis and scholars within the Jewish nation that wrote a commentary on the Bible itself. That's what they believe, that it was making up for the firstborn within the Levitical tribes. I think it must be either that or that, yes, there were 22,300 total based on those numbers, but that not all of them were eligible for tabernacle service. Because nowhere in these records of this census does the Lord say, okay, go take account of all the Levites, but make sure you're only counting the ones that are eligible for service. Nowhere does he say that. And if you remember, anyone that touched any aspect of the tabernacle, they had to be without blemish. Do you remember that? We studied that. It wasn't just the sacrifices that had to be without blemish. The priests and the workers, they had to be without blemish too. So if you were maimed in some way or diseased in some way, you could not be a priest and you could not be a Levitical worker and handle the things of the tabernacle. So I think whatever it is, whether it's the accounting for the firstborn within the Levitical tribes, or whether it is the final number once you subtract all those that were ineligible to serve as Levitical workers, regardless of it, I think what you have is a total number, and now you have the total number at the end of only those eligible to serve as priests. As Levitical workers, because the Lord couldn't count those that would not be eligible to work for him. I think eligibility is what this is all about. For some reason or another, my take on it is that 300 of these Levites did not make the final cut. Figuring out why, that's a matter that we can speculate about, but I'm pretty sure that's what we're looking at here. So, this actually encourages me. And I believe that if the Lord says, here's the individual numbers, but here's the total, 22,000 even, then whatever the reason for the subtraction of that 300 people, I trust the Lord with that. The Lord knows what he's doing, and I don't so much need to know why, but I can understand there are some very good possible reasons why this number might be different. Well, enough of that. Here is the call for a census of all the firstborn males now. We know the total number of Levites. Let's check out the total number of firstborn males within the nation. Verse 40, and the Lord said to Moses, list all the firstborn males of the people of Israel from a month old and upward. So he's basing this on the same criteria. Taking the number of their names, verse 41, and you shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord. Instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of all the Levites, instead of the firstborn among the cattle of the people of Israel. Verse 42, so Moses listed all the firstborn among the people of Israel, as the Lord commanded him, 43, and all the firstborn males, according to the number of names, from a month old and upward, as listed, were 22,273, verse 44, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 45, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle. The Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. Okay, so crunching the numbers, you have 22,000 eligible Levites that make the final cut, and you have 22,273 firstborn Those numbers are very close. 22,273 souls. That is what's owed to the Lord from the nation. The Lord has 22,000 on hand in the tribe of Levi. So it is 273 souls that the Lord calculates that the people of Israel owe him as ministry workers. And you would expect the Lord to call this a wash, wouldn't you? All right, you owe me 22,273. I got 22,000. Good enough. Let's call it even and move on. But is that what the Lord does? Let's see what he does. Verse 46. And as the redemption price for the 273 of the firstborn of the people of Israel, over and above the number of the male Levites, verse 47, you shall take 5 shekels per head. You shall take them according to the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel of 20 gerahs, verse 48, and give the money to Aaron and his sons as the redemption price for those who are over, verse 49. So Moses took the redemption money from those who were over and above those redeemed by the Levites, verse 50. From the firstborn of the people of Israel, he took the money, 1,365 shekels by the shekel of the sanctuary, verse 51. And Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and his sons according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. So again, God says, you owe me 273 souls. So here's what I'll do. I will let you pay me the equivalent value that each one of those souls would have provided for me in the form of labor. So they're paying money to make up for these 273 souls. Now that might seem like nitpicking to you. That might seem like God is nickel and diming the nation. But this is actually a good thing. This is God confirming what we already know about him. That he is not a ballpark kind of God. That he is not a close enough kind of God. He is a just God. He is a perfect God. He is perfect in all of his exchanges. And every one of his judgments and every one of his decisions and every one of his exchanges is absolutely true, perfect, fair, and equal for everyone. Now think about how important that aspect of God's character and nature is when you start filtering that through spiritual ideas and concepts. Think about how important it is that God doesn't let people slide for their sins. Oh, well, close enough to perfect. Come on in. You know what it does? The fact that God doesn't just, oh, well, close enough or ballpark, good enough. The fact that God's not like that, what it does is it pushes us to grace. And that is very important. It pushes us to salvation by grace through our faith and not self-faith. Self-faith is the problem. It's why we need salvation. So to understand this about God, to know that he doesn't just let sin slide and that we don't just get to heaven and find out, well, did I do good enough? Well, grading on the curve, come on in. You know, the bass player, he was worse. Come on in. This keeps us from being works-based, and it keeps us as saved by grace through our faith. And then it also means that God is not going to let your enemies slide for the things that they've done to you. It's, you know, probably they didn't really mean it. We should just probably leave well enough alone. Let's let them off the hook. The Lord does not do that. How about the book of life? Think of how important it is that God keeps account of every name and every soul. Think of how important that is. You know, you get to heaven and the Lord says, your name is not in the book of life. Lord, I believe by faith. Well, you're not in here. But I'm at like 98% effective with my names in this book. So we just, you know, we'll leave it at that. I'm really by bulk and by majority, I'm right in the 98th percentile. That's very accurate. Well, you would be very brokenhearted and disappointed for eternity if you were the 2% that God missed. But the Lord doesn't miss. And lastly, I'll just say this. How about the promises of God? If God made you 22,000 promises, No, if God made you 22,273 promises, but he only kept 22,000 of them, how would you feel about that? I mean, 22,000 promises kept out of 22,273 promises made. Those are good statistics. That's a good exchange rate. Yes, but it weakens our faith, Lord, that you are absolutely, perfectly true to your word. So this aspect of the character and nature of God is very important that it be in place. It is encouraging to us because it tells us that God is perfectly consistent at being perfect in all things.